Hello, welcome to the Rest is History bonus episode. And I am still at Goalhanger Towers because my broadband, which has been out for a week and a half now, is still off. Dominic, however, you're not having these annoying problems, are you?
No, this is another, don't live in the city.
It's a fan, apparently, reversed into whatever it is that enables broadband to work.
Wow, really?
Yeah. So, all very exciting.
Crikey.
So, I just want the listeners to know that it's, you know... It's been such an effort and a slog for me, but I'm doing it for you.
Oh, that's nice.
Because I care, because I'm all heart.
That's really nice. So, Tom, we have reached a milestone, I believe. We have now recorded 300 official episodes of The Rest is History. Now, the weird thing is that's just a completely arbitrary figure because we've done all the bonus episodes.
I know.
And then we've done some episodes that don't count in the normal run. So the 12 Days of Christmas, I think, aren't counted.
Are they non-canonical?
They're non-canonical, exactly. But we've recorded 300 canonical episodes of The Rest is History.
Now, that's an insane number, isn't it?
Did you think it would run? I didn't think it would run for 300 episodes.
Yes, you did.
I didn't. When you rang me up and said, would you like to do a podcast? If you'd said for 300 episodes, I would have been
just run screaming for the hills. Well, because I am always ringing you up and asking you to do things.
Yeah.
I'm aware of that. To be honest, I didn't think it would. Well, because we didn't know it was going to...
Have any listeners.
But also we didn't really know very much about podcasts, did we?
Nothing. Nothing. We still don't know. That's the weird thing. We still don't know anything about doing podcasts.
Except, Dominic, I saw somebody tweeted to me over the weekend. There was something in one of the German newspapers in which they'd spoken to you. So you've been slying off and talking to German journalists.
Is that right? Really?
Yeah. And it was about Goalhanger, who produce Us and Restless Politics.
Is that in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung?
Yes, it was.
I haven't read that because you are always sending me links to newspapers that I don't subscribe to.
You didn't have to subscribe to it.
I've never spoken to them.
Well, you're in it.
Well, that's good.
Clearly.
It depends on the context.
But it was describing the success of Goalhanger.
Right.
And talking about the rest is politics and Rory Stewart and Alistair Campbell.
Okay, I don't approve of that.
And then it came to us.
Yeah,
and it said
that I do approve of.
It said Rest is History is also presented by two men who have seen their best, days.
What?
Or something to that effect.
What?
It was kind of two men who are also halfway to the grave.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was.
That's outrageous.
And, so I put that out on Twitter and quite a lot of Germans apologetically said that this was typical of German journalistic humour.
The Germans, they haven't changed, Tom. Oh, my word.
Anyway.
Crikey.
But what we have to guard on these bonuses is self-congratulations.
Yes, let's not have any of that.
We have been given by Sam three messages. So we've one from Kathy Curtin-Johnson. Been with you from the beginning. It's been a fantastic ride, and you've kept me company on my commuting journeys back to university to get my MA and now my PhD in European history after raising kids at home for years. Thanks for reminding me so often why I'm doing this. So that is...
That's brilliant.
That's a lovely message.
Good for you,
to get,
Kathy.
Isn't it?
Good for you.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. And Jack Shaw is paying tribute to the fantastic episode you did on Gannibal. I forever have the answer to the quiz question, who's the most famous Cameroonian general to fight for Russia in the 18th century in the locker?
That's true, as I did as well, because
I also learned from that. And then Daryl Hare, who says, I mean, he's being lovely, he's saying it's a very good podcast. But Daryl Hare is, I think, an Australian umpire.
Umpire?
He's an umpire. He notoriously no-balled the Sri Lankan spin bowler, Muthiah Muralitharan, for throwing.
And you're sure it's the same Daryl Hare, Tom?
I don't know.
Let's hope it is.
But if it is, it would be great, wouldn't it?
It would be great.
We've got Julia Gillard. So we've got an Australian Prime Minister. It'd be brilliant to have an Australian Test umpire.
That's kind of all Australia, really, isn't it? Prime ministers. I mean, basically, cricketers and Prime Ministers. I mean, that's what they've got to offer. Yes. So lots to get through on today's bonus episode. We've just launched, haven't we, the series about the Cathars, Tom, which starts with an episode about the Da Vinci Code. And we had a question within moments of releasing the episode from Thoughtfully Catholic on Twitter that we hadn't really thought about, which is this. If Jesus and Mary Magdalene did get married and have children and had this sacred bloodline, but if Jesus is not the Son of God, then
who cares?
Yeah, who cares? Why?
Okay, so I was thinking that as you were talking about it, but you then went on to say that the key to the bloodline is that it's the bloodline of David.
Yes, it is the bloodline. But so again, so what?
Well, because the Messiah will come from the line of David. So presumably, Pierre Plantard, or whatever his name was.
Yeah.
Who was...
Yeah, but he didn't put in, Pierre Plantard did not put in the detail about Jesus. He was all about the Merovingian kings.
But don't they know about him? Is he in the Holy Blood and Holy Grail? I can't remember.
They don't realise they've been hoaxed by him.
By him. Okay. But whoever, I imagine the answer would be that at some point, the Priory of Zion are guarding this bloodline because it will produce the Messiah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm guessing.
So it's a future. So it's... You know, it's an investment in youth.
It's an investment in the future.
Exactly. Yes. Rather than in the past. Okay, that makes sense now.
So things are looking, you know, I mean, as they are now, things, you know, not great in Europe. So it's kind of like investing in, you know, gas terminals and things. It's a long-term investment in Europe's future.
Yeah. Nick Clegg made this mistake with nuclear power station in 2010. Remember?
Yes. Yeah.
He said
the government closing down deep sea gas storage facilities. Yeah.
There's a clip online of the Deputy Prime Minister in about 2010 saying, no, I don't believe in a nuclear power station for Britain because it would only come online in about 2022.
And if you'd had that in 1099, Godfrey de Bouillon, refusing to found the Priory of Sion because the Messiah wouldn't kick in until what, 2026?
Yeah.
We'd laugh, wouldn't we?
We would. So online, a fellow called Charlie Radcliffe said, he suggested, when he saw, people often do this, and I just think it's so weird, because they must know we've already recorded the episode. So we put out our tweets this morning saying, today's episode is about the Da Vinci Code. And Charlie Radcliffe said, oh, you should get Michael Bagent on the episode. Give him a call. He was one of the authors of the Holy Blood and Holy Braille, and he knew my father. But obviously, at that point, it's too late to give him a call. Not least because as pointed out, he's been dead since 2013. And then Barry Grogan, who's a long time listener to The Rest Is History, piled in. He said, if you want to raise guests from the dead for the show, no offense,
Michael.
No offense to the late Mr. Bagent, but it'd be better to go for Caesar, Napoleon, or Jim Callahan.
He's got a point.
Yeah. Our first dead guest probably won't be Michael Bagent.
It would be, we could get the Ouija board out,
but Tom,
and have the first podcast with
dead guests.
With a dead guest. First history podcast with a dead guest would be quite...
There's a great scope for a spin-off in that, isn't there? We could just employ actors, or you could do impersonations.
So like The Rest Is Politics have got this new spin-off where they interview people.
Yeah. But they were alive. How boring.
Yeah. Now, so would we, what would we do about the language?
The language?
Yeah.
Would you, you interview Julius Caesar in Latin?
In Latin. Yeah.
Well, maybe we could have enormous fun with that. We could have interpreters. You know, we could have two actors, one playing the guest and one playing the interpreter.
Well, it's certainly food for thought there.
It would be a demanding listen.
And the other thing on the Da Vinci Code, several people have, we're recording this early on Monday, and several people have already recommended a parody of the Da Vinci Code by Michael Deacon.
Oh, yeah.
Writing in the Daily Telegraph about 10 years ago.
Yeah, I remember reading that at the time. It was very funny.
So I've got it here. Renowned author Dan Brown got out of his luxurious four-poster bed in his expensive $10 million house and paced the bedroom using the feet located at the ends of his two legs to propel him forwards. He knew he shouldn't care what a few jealous podcasters thought. His new book, Inferno, was coming out on Tuesday, and the 480-page hardback published by Doubleday with a recommended US retail price of $29.95 was sure to be a hit, wasn't it? We were not being original with our jokes at
no,
all.
No, I didn't realise. I'd forgotten style. That. Well, I mean, you can't start a book with the word renowned.
We expect to get away with
it. No, absolutely. So, Tom, you've also been busy this week tweeting articles from the Financial Times, another newspaper that I can't read because I don't have a subscription to. What caught your eye in the Financial Times?
So this is by Janan Ganesh, who is an excellent commentator. In fact, listens to The Rest Is History.
But wrote an article saying he thought podcasts were useless and a waste of time.
Yeah, he did.
But, he shamed himself with that.
But in that article, he did say that he listened to The Rest Is History.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, cut him some slack. He was writing about why cultural institutions in Britain, in the United States, I'm guessing in other countries as well, are invariably left-wing.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that all institutions, unless they're consciously right-wing, drift to the left. I can't remember who came up with
it. It's one of Robert Service's. Robert Conquest's laws, isn't it? Yeah.
And his argument on this was that people on the right tend to be both more individualistic, so less likely to join organizations, but more importantly, more interested in money.
Right.
And that therefore, rather than, you know, as an academic, you're going to be very, relatively speaking, badly paid compared to, you know, a merchant banker or something like that. And I thought that was a very interesting argument.
I think it's an excellent argument, Tom, and actually worth slightly developing. So if you were to go back to, let's say, the 1970s, because I've seen these figures about how academics voted, academics tended to be, there was much more of a split. So, in other words, it might, I mean, there are a lot of, so in the 70s Britain, there are an awful lot of conservative voting university lecturers, but also
Tolkien was not a left wing.
But also there were conservative voting students. So when people did, I think it's in about 1969, there was a survey of students at the University of Leeds, and a plurality, you know, the biggest group said they would vote conservative at the next general election, which is a huge contrast, obviously, with now. Now, I think with regard to institutions, I don't think it's the danger with that saying it's because other people are interested in money is you basically cast everybody else as really greedy and academics as kind of virtuous and you know, sort of public spirited. I think there is a definite, what's happened is that the salaries that you earn, particularly to work in universities, but also in cultural institutions, have declined so radically over time. So you think about what a university don would have been earning in the mid-20th century, they would have been earning enough to have a big kind of Victorian villa in North Oxford, let's say, send their children to private schools, foreign holidays, all of those things that are basically out of reach for university lecturers now. So if you are socially, economically ambitious and aspirational, that's obviously not a career that you would go into. You're not just passionate about your subject, but you have a sense of mission, don't you think? And if you have that sense of mission and you've gone into museum studies, the chances are you're probably on the left. You see yourself as changing the world.
So I haven't been keeping on top of this, and I hesitate to stray into the cultural politics of the United States, but isn't this something that Ron DeSantis in Florida is very keen to reverse?
Yeah.
The sense that... Well, it's not a sense. I mean, it seems to be true that everyone in academics in the United States are overwhelmingly on the left. And he is, I think, isn't he kind of basically pointing a gun at the universities and saying, you've got to have right-wing academics or else? I may be slightly simplifying.
I don't know what he's been doing with universities. I know what he's done is he's banned the teaching of critical race theory, as they call it. So,
or has he banned it totally? Or he said that there have to be black conservative academics or something. But I think he is, I mean, I think he's consciously, in a sense, trying to buck the market. Because I'd have thought that, you know, people on the right in America are all about the free operation of labor and the right people to choose what they want to do. And if right-wing people want to go off and work in Wall Street, and left-wing people want to talk about critical race theory in Florida universities, I mean, that's the way it is, isn't it?
Maybe he wants, I haven't followed it very closely, but maybe he wants affirmative action for...
but that's a very left-wing take, isn't
it? Conservative. I'm thinking back to sort of 25 years or so to when I was doing my PhD in American history. And there was definitely a sense then that academic historians who were not on the left were seen as eccentric, I would say. I think there was always a place for the conservative academic, but they were sort of cast in a bit of a role of being oh, he's conservative, but actually he's still quite nice. He's still quite civilized. Whether that place still exists, I'm actually not sure. So in other words, they went from being a substantial part of the academic elite to being a kind of eccentric tweedy redoubt.
Yeah.
And now maybe that even that role no longer exists. Or you go to work at a very conservative university in the United States, or you go to work at the Hoover Institution at Stanford or something. Now, Britain has no equivalent of that. So in other words, if you're a conservative academic at Keele, I don't know where you go.
But, I mean, again, the right-wing perspective might be that where there is a gap in the market, that creates opportunity.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm reading the reviews of a new book by the Regius Professor of Moral Theology.
Oh, yes.
At Oxford, Nigel Bigger, on colonialism, which I don't think is saying the British Empire was a good thing, but it was saying it wasn't a wholly bad thing.
Right.
Which, by the standards of 2023, is a very radical position to take.
Yeah.
And he's duly been dumped on by pretty much every academic I know.
Yes.
But that is obviously a position that you can stake out as a writer and get attention, because you're saying something that is contrary to what pretty much everybody else is saying.
You can, but I think that's quite a lone.
But if you have the hide of a rhinoceros, as Nigel Bigger clearly does, that offers you scope to be heard, to have your book published.
It does,
even though it was, I gather, almost cancelled.
Cancelled by Bloomsbury, his first publisher. Yeah, I think so. The debate there with Nigel Bigger is he's written this stuff about the British Empire, and he convened this very controversial seminar series, and then 58 academics at his own institution signed a letter to try to basically distance.
But this was in 2020, so this was the absolute peak.
I think it was actually before. I think it was actually before 2020, Tom.
Was it?
Okay. Yeah, I think it was even before that. But so then there's this strange thing where Nigel Bigger resurfaces every 3 months to write an article in the Times
saying he's been silenced,
and then all his critics go howling onto Twitter and say, "How can he be silenced if he's writing these articles in the Times or the Daily Telegraph or whatever?" And these two sort of irreconcilable forces never meet. I suppose the thing is, he has now got a role as the man that the Times go to. So in that sense, he hasn't been silenced. But he's not going to be welcome at a conference discussing, an academic conference discussing the British Empire. He's seen as persona non grata. And I suppose the only way that you can function would be to say, well, I'm just going to embrace that role. And maybe a lot of historians don't want to do that. Maybe a lot of historians just want to be a historian rather than to have this badge on that says I'm a very left-wing historian or a conservative historian or whatever.
Of course. But there's also an organization Restoring History or something. It's a kind of don't chuck down the statues organization.
Yeah.
It has David Abulafia, who's very distinguished historian. He's always writing about oceans and
Robert,
seas.
Robert Toombs,
history of the English, very distinguished historian of France, who are very heavyweight historians.
But crucially, retired. I think that is the key. In other words, I think if you were being, these are retired Cambridge historians who are sort of cross about the way history is going, and they've got nothing to lose.
So they're like the corpse of El Cid tied to a horse.
I suppose so. I'm sure neither of them would be delighted with that comparison, Tom. But yeah, I think if you were young, if you were 30 or mid-career, and you sort of thought, it's not even just about being conservative, I think, so much as tilting against the orthodoxy, then I think maybe it's not as congenial an environment as it could be.
Yeah, I suppose, but where there is an orthodoxy, there is a name to be made for yourself by tilting against it.
That's right, but you have to want to be that contrarian. I mean, I always think...
Yes, you do.
I think the danger of being a contrarian is you end up then becoming a contrarian for contrarianism's sake, and ultimately you become Neil Oliver.
Or what's his name? The brother of... Christopher Hitchens, whose name I can't
Peter
remember.
Hitchens. Peter Hitchens. Yes. Yeah, you say exactly. That's a temptation in and of itself, to use the young people's lingo. You wait to hear what the libs are saying, and then you just say the opposite. Yeah. I mean, that seems to me a very unsatisfying.
Well, that was very evident in the early days of the pandemic, when people couldn't decide whether they were in favor of masks or not, whether they were in favor of letting lots of Chinese people in or not. And it kept kind of veering around depending on which position Trump was taking.
Exactly. Yeah. So sorry, anyway. This has been very golf club, hasn't it? The last 10 minutes or so of this.
No, I don't think so. I think it's been an interesting analysis of the way that
Tom, that's
cultural
nice.
Capital operates.
Yeah. I mean, I do think the thing with these institutions, this institutional battles, oh, we need to fight, you know, the conservatives sort of say, the truth of the matter is, as you say, conservative minded people don't want to go and work for the, you know, British Museum. By and large, I would guess, because they want to go and work for Goldman Sachs.
Although against that, Janan Ganesh, he suggested that Boris Johnson could have gone and run a museum rather than kind of going around earning squadillions, giving talks about Ukraine.
Yeah.
But actually, of course, George Osborne, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, is the chair of the British Museum. I mean, he has about 10 other jobs as well.
Yes.
But he has. So it's
you're more connected with the British Museum than I am, but isn't there a critic of that say, but George Osborne actually isn't very conservative. George Osborne is a metropolitan liberal kind of Notting Hill.
He imposed austerity.
Yeah. He's an economically dry, but so he's socially liberal.
Well, there are many shades of conservatism.
There are indeed.
And he was certainly conservative enough to get booed.
Okay, at the Olympics. We spent 20 minutes, we haven't really talked enough about history.
Apologize to our listeners.
Let's talk about Hatshepsut. So, Tom, Rosa asked a question about sources. Are you using inscriptions? Are you using written stuff?
Well, he's also specifically saying the limited sources you're using come in, e.g. that autopsy report. This is my fault. I didn't make it clear that this autopsy report is the report that was done by the pathologist in whenever it was, the 1910s or whatever, who got the bodies. We don't have autopsy reports from ancient Egypt.
Okay.
I mean, we don't have any. All these autopsy reports are reports that are done on the mummies.
But Rawls's question more generally about sources. What sources are there for the life of, you know, 18th century pharaohs? 19th century, 18th dynasty pharaohs.
The sources are almost invariably inscriptions.
Yeah.
As we said in the episode, we don't have the equivalent of a Suetonius. Suetonius, the Roman biographer who gives us the lives of the 12 Caesars from Julius Caesar through to Domitian. And these are full of kind of details about, I don't know, the complexion of their skin, their sexual tastes, what they liked, you know, the kind of food they ate, all this kind of stuff that you want and that humanizes them and means that Rome, I think, seems much closer to us than Egypt does.
Yeah.
The whole aim with Egypt is, and indeed with Persia and with the civilizations of the Near East, is to merge the individual with the kind of hieratic, the impersonal, the symbolic. And that makes it very difficult to get beneath them. And as we said in the episode, that's why Hatshepsut and Akhenaten, Hatshepsut because she's a woman, Akhenaten because he's trying to overthrow the entire established order, because there is an inherent tension between them as individuals and the role that they have to play as pharaoh. That is why we have a sense of them as individuals, perhaps to a greater degree than we do with any other. Even with them, it's very difficult to get a handle on them. And that is the problem. Yeah. I think, I mean, you said that ancient Egypt is, everybody knows ancient Egypt. It's an absolute banker.
Yeah.
But at the same time, people don't really know anything about the individual pharaohs. No. And that's true of Egyptologists as much as it is for primary school children.
Yeah. So we had a couple of questions about, so Hagar, for example, was under the impression that even the way she became regent was extraordinary, since usually it was the biological mother of the baby king who gets to be regent, and she wasn't.
Yeah. So that's a reason for wondering whether perhaps she fixed on the baby Thutmose as a kind of patsy.
Yes. But then Hagar says, was she the best patron to young Thutmose III, molding him into the formidable king that he would turn? Because he was arguably the most formidable of all Egyptian pharaohs.
Again, I think there must be a case for that.
Yeah.
You know, again, we said the conventional idea that her monuments get defaced because Thutmose was kind of twisted with resentment and anger.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be true, because her monuments are left in place for for several decades after Thutmose comes to the throne. And it's evident from the way in which he immediately proves himself as an extraordinary war leader. You know, he's not doing this from nowhere. He's clearly been trained and raised and schooled in the requirements for that kind of leadership. And who else would he have been schooled by if not Hatshepsut?
Well, as we've said in the past, you don't win wars. You know, you win them with an infrastructure and with resources and with organization. And all of those things must have been in place, you would imagine, at the end of, before he comes onto the throne, that he's inheriting a machine for waging war, I would guess.
Yes. And if you have a machine, you have to know how to operate it.
Yeah.
You have to be trained to operate it.
Klaz, greatest female pharaoh, yes. Where does she rank against greatest pharaohs as a whole? So, Tom, the top three or four pharaohs, can you, do you want to give us your rundown?
It's so difficult because the standards by which you would judge greatness change. You know, we're talking 3,000-year period. They change over the, say, from the Old Kingdom.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd say Cheops or Khephren because, but we don't really know anything about them.
Yeah.
But a measure of their greatness is the fact that they've got two absolutely enormous pyramids stuck at Giza. I mean, you would say that that has to be a measure of greatness. It's not perhaps one that we would recognize.
No,
or
we'd reward.
Well, we recognize it, but we it's a measure of greatness that is so alien to us that would we even accept it as being a greatness? Probably not. But clearly by Egyptian standards, that is the case. Dossa, who is the first, who employs Imhotep, the great architect who builds a step pyramid that is the kind of the primal pyramid. There's a whole range of pharaohs in the Middle Kingdom whose names are so, I'm going to put my hand up, I can't actually remember them. But there's a pharaoh with absolutely enormous ears in the Middle Kingdom.
Right.
And people always said, you know, he looks like the king.
Yeah.
But actually, the likelihood is that these ears are expressive of his ability to hear a pin drop anywhere in Egypt.
Mm.
So he's a kind of Stalinist king.
Crikey.
Again, would we say that is great? I would say that by the standards of the 18th dynasty, which is probably the period we know best in the 19th dynasty, you've got Amos, Hatshepsut, Thutmose III, Amenhotep III, the Sun King, Ramesses II.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all big hitters.
Yeah.
But in a way, they are kings of a kind that is familiar to us. The pharaohs from the Middle and the Old Kingdom are stranger and weirder.
Right. But they're still empire builders, aren't they, those early pharaohs?
They're not. I don't think they're empire builders in the way that the 18th dynasty pharaohs become empire builders. They don't seem to have been hugely interested in what lay beyond the boundaries of Egypt.
Okay.
Everything, you know, Egypt is all that matters.
Like a Chinese sort of emperor or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or like the caliphate in the Middle Ages, not really caring what Western Europe's doing.
So on Egypt, Tony says, more on Egypt, please. Fascinated by it, but daunted to delve in. Where to start? What books would you recommend? So I'm looking at my shelves and
Toby Wilkinson.
Toby Wilkinson, The Rise and Fall of Ancient Egypt. That's my go-to. Any others, Tom? So John Romer, who is doing this huge long series with Penguin about the history of Penguin history.
He's a wonderful writer.
Eventually, I've never read his stuff.
Barry Kemp, who excavated at Amarna. Joyce Tardsley, who we quoted, wrote books about Hatshepsut and Cleopatra and books about gods. Guy de la Bedouere has just written a book about the 18th dynasty.
Oh, yes, he has.
Very accessible. Yes. So there's lots of great stuff.
Yeah.
And we will definitely come back to it. I think, because we were talking about doing Anubis, weren't we? Your childhood trauma where you, what was it? You weren't allowed to wear your Anubis mask.
I think I had tonsillitis. I think I missed wearing the Anubis mask. I didn't want Anubis. He wasn't my first choice. I wanted Osiris. I was kind of given Anubis by Mrs. Mason. I put a lot of effort into that mask. It was like a head thing, papier-mâché. My first real go at papier-mâché, Tom, actually.
Yeah.
And this is a big thing for me because my art teacher, Mrs. Salt, told my parents that in 20 years of teaching, I was the single worst person at art she'd ever taught.
Right. So was your Anubis head terrible?
Well, I can't remember. It's a long time ago.
But in a way, it's lucky you weren't Osiris, because that you wouldn't have had a penis.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Would have been eaten by a fish.
Yes, well, but that we didn't do that bit at school.
Did you not?
No, we didn't.
So through the prism of Anubis, we could do mummies.
I think we should do Egyptian religion, because Sambrook Jr. is obsessed by Egyptian gods and Egyptian magic, and he would love that.
We'll do that. And the pyramids.
So last week, we also did The Real Downton Abbey, which was basically the story of domestic servants with Lucy Lethbridge. All your questions about that, we had lots of questions. I would imagine many of them will be answered if you read Lucy's book, which is absolutely jam. I mean, we always do our best to sort of plug our authors' books, but Servants is a really, really cracking read, isn't it, Tom? Her other book. Yeah. If you like sort of historical anecdotes and funny details and things, it's full of them. But Fable Skull, one of our listeners, makes an interesting point. Or he or she says, the point that early 20th century hierarchy still permeates English society in an albeit zombie form is very true. Not sure that's quite how I'd put it, but as an insider stroke outsider to England, born outside, raised inside, I always tell my European friends that you will never understand England until you grasp the nuances of class. I say that neutrally. It just is. Tom, you agree with that?
Isn't it a reflection of the fact that Britain, and I think it's not just England, I think it's Britain,
mm-hmm.
because it didn't have a revolution.
Yeah.
It wasn't occupied. It didn't experience dictatorship. So it didn't experience the kind of erasure of the pre-Great War class structures.
Agreed.
Does preserve them to a degree that is unusual and surprising.
I think there are a couple of things. I think, first of all, I always say, it's Americans who often ask me about this, and I always say, you're deluded if you think that America doesn't have a class system and Britain does.
No, but let's put America to one side for the moment and talk about Europe.
But same with Europe. So the French have a class system. They have you know, upper middle class people who go to the very best schools, who go on to, you know, the Sciences Po or the ENA, the École Nationale.
But they're kind of more like grammar school boys, aren't they? I mean, because all the...
Grammar school boys themselves in Britain were overwhelmingly middle class.
Yeah, but often kind of lower middle class, aspirationally middle class.
I think that's the stereotype, but how the truth of the matter is the richer your parents, the more likely you were to go to a grammar school. That's the reality that the sort of...
Of course.
The grammar school aficionados don't always acknowledge.
Of course. But I mean, we had the guy writing the book about Rennes le Château.
Yeah,
who was he was an aristocrat. He was reduced to churning out all his rubbish.
An aristocrat fallen on hard times. Exactly, you're right. I have seen people. I think David Cannadine makes this argument. He says England and or Britain are not unique in having a class system, but they have a uniquely rich and continuous language with which to talk about it.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's the discourse of class that is unique rather than the existence of a class system. But
also the lack of violent ruptures.
Yeah, it means there's a continuity. Agreed. And so you will absolutely get that thing where there will be a big house and the people living on the house. I mean, I'm just thinking about near me, Broughton Castle, which is between Chipping Norton and Banbury. That's the Fiennes house. Ray Fiennes, the actor, Joseph Fiennes, their family.
And William Fiennes.
Yeah.
Great writer.
Yes.
Who plays for the authors.
Just play for the authors. So the Fiennes have been there, I think, for about 800 years, 900 years.
The Battle of Edge Hill was fought just over the...
It was indeed.
The crest of the hill.
So there's an absolute continuity there.
We play a match about 5 miles from there.
Where'd you play? Great Chew or somewhere like that?
It's not Great Chew. It's where? Shennington, I think.
Oh, yeah. Shennington.
Shennington. We warm up by going for a swim around the moat.
Oh, yeah. The moat is lovely.
But we have discussions in the team about which of us is the poshest.
Oh, right.
And it's between Will Fiennes, who doesn't actually own a castle because he's the youngest son.
Right.
And Peter Frankopan, who's
he's a prince.
He's the heir of the king of Croatia or something.
Yeah.
So it's a heated...
I don't think a foreign royal, Tom, is as high as a younger son.
As an English. I think you're right.
I mean, it's certainly true that you don't get you won't understand England in particular. I mean, I think it is England in particular, though, Tom, isn't it? Much. I mean, I'm not saying there isn't class in Wales, that's Scotland,
massive,
and Ireland.
Massive class in Scotland,
of course. But England in particular is obsessed, is a country obsessed by its own class system, fascinated by it. Don't you think?
I think the Scots are too.
Do you?
Lairds, gillies, all that kind of stuff. I mean, they're endlessly going on. I mean, most of Scotland is owned by the aristocracy.
I mean, I think what people find fascinating is the extent to which class in Britain or in England is delineated by dress, by speech, by accent, to an extent that that's not really true, for example, in the United States or I would guess in France or Germany or something. I mean, I think they have class distinctions, but I don't think they are as they don't have the enormously
the
sophisticated. Yeah. So that, in other words, we often joke in the podcast because of the running joke about the Kaiser wearing the wrong shoes at the cows week and that being the source of the resentment that led to World War One. But that thing about wearing the wrong shoes, that has a massive resonance in a country where you wearing the wrong shoes would immediately be that would get you noticed and people would remember that for the rest of your life if you wore the wrong shoes.
But it's been incredibly scrambled since the 60s, hasn't it? When being working class became something for upper class people to affect.
Yeah, but that's only for a brief period, I would say.
I don't know.
Tom, I will say that simply this. At my boarding school, so I'm giving myself away here, at my boarding school in about 1990, a boy 2 years above me, I think, called Andy Phillips, came home from an exeat wearing a hooded top. And all the other boys in the house, so that's 60 boys, immediately, took against him and started taking the mickey out of him. The hooded top was discarded on day one and never, ever worn again.
Yeah, but
the reason
now,
was,
but not now,
because the hooded top was seen as, now, of course, you would wear a hooded top now, but because the hooded top was seen as déclassé. And this is among 14, 15, 16-year-olds. But by the way, before people say, oh, God, these schools, they're so terrible, that's not imposed by the teachers. I mean, it's not like the teachers are sitting there egging you on. This is the boys
Dominic,
themselves.
I think you were massively showing your age.
Do you not think there are... But Tom, I think you are being incredibly naive if you think that there aren't similar occurrences, that the same thing is not taking place today. It might not be a hooded top. Okay, it's not going to be a hooded top because
everyone's wearing a hooded
right.
top. No, there will be other ways of doing it, but it's scramble. It's, you could used to be able to say Sloan Ranger Handbook, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That if you, there would be recognizably posh ways of wearing clothes.
Yes, I think there still are.
And that is still the case.
There's still
the way. But it is scrambled because lots of very posh people now go out of their way not to look posh. And so they wear a kind of, it's like German spies.
I don't agree.
I've got Theo sitting next to me.
Yeah. He's quite posh, is he, Theo? What's he wearing?
I can't even begin to describe
it. He's not wearing spats, is he, Tom?
He's not wearing spats. Dominic, I give you Tim Westwood, the son of a bishop.
And what's he wearing? He's a DJ.
Well, he's the voice of hip hop.
Well, he was about 10 years ago.
But then I think he got accused of...
Yeah, he's been cancelled, Tom. I don't think he counts. I think the class...
Anyway, listen.
I think we should do a whole podcast about class in England because I think it is such a fascinating subject. I think it is... I don't think it's as scrambled as you say it is. I think...
That's because you live in Chipping Norton. I live in Brixton. I'm surrounded by very, very posh people who are all pretending that they grew up in the ghetto.
I would agree with you. I do think if you come out of London and out of sort of gentrified... slightly hipsterish London, I think the class system is very
Middle England is Middle England, but
I mean there used to be a thing. I don't know whether they still do it. In my town, there used to be a thing on Boxing Day, there would be the ride of the local hunt, and the houses of the sort of ordinary people in Chipping Norton would decamp their population onto the pavements, and then the sort of toffs, as it were, would have gathered outside the Fox Inn or something to have a drink, and then they would all ride off to do the hunt, basically applauded by the rest of the town. And it was such a demonstration of the sort of class system Was it deferential? No, it wasn't deferential, but it was a definitely a sort of ritualistic aspect to it. I mean, when I say they used to do that, I mean,
they're not doing it anymore.
I'm talking about 2018. I think it was probably cancelled because of the pandemic, Tom.
I mean, posh people go riding off on horses,
yeah,
pretending to not kill foxes.
Yeah.
But posh people are also going out and trying to stop hunts and glue themselves to...
Yes.
You know, because that's a very posh thing too.
Well, Extinction Rebellion are all double-barreled names, yeah.
Yes, it's all, oh no, I'm so upset, you know, we've got to stop, save the planet.
But I can't go on next week's demo because we're going skiing that week.
they're not that hypocritical. I mean, it's not hypocrisy because they are all living in squats and they really passionately believe it. And, you know,
I'm absolutely here, Tom, by the way, for stamping on posh youngsters. I'm all about well-meaning, progressive, posh youngsters. I'm all about
that. I know you are. Because that's your whole shtick.
That's the brand.
That's the brand.
Yeah.
But yeah. I would say that that environmentalists,
yeah,
who chain themselves to bridges, are just as posh often as if not posher than the kind of people who go fox hunting.
George Monbiot, the high priest of environmentalism, went to Stowe.
Yeah, right.
His father was Raymond Monbiot, who's the head of a right-wing businessman's organization.
Anyway, this has been a very, very golf club.
On that theme,
I think a point from Stuart Reed, which is interesting and refers back to earlier episodes, when the discussion was about the prevalence of social hierarchies, I did immediately think of Sam and Frodo's relationship and what it represents. So that's a very good point.
That's an excellent point.
When you look at the classics of English literature, of English, particularly children's literature, class is everywhere.
It's there
in Harry Potter, because what are muggles if not the unwashed, the great unwashed, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, being a wizard or a witch or whatever is simply a recalibration of the idea that certain people deserve to go to boarding schools and certain people don't.
So you posted on Twitter a few days ago a thing saying somebody asked you about schools and you said, oh, Dominic would love to do an episode about boarding schools, which I would, because I've been talking about it ad nauseam. Because I'm fascinated by the history of boarding schools, but also boarding schools' place in fiction. And one listener said, oh, it won't be accessible to 95% of the population then, or something. Obviously not a fan of such institutions. And I said, well, it'll be accessible to anybody who's heard of Harry Potter. And, you know, Harry Potter is as you say, I mean, it's an absolutely classic boarding school story. It's based on the template of Tom Brown's school days. There can be no doubt about that at all. And I think The Wind in the Willows... The Wind in the Willows is one of the most loved of all English children's stories. Is a book about class.
Oikes from the estate.
Toad, Mole and Rat are the kind of upper middle class, aren't they? Badger, I guess, is quite
the squire.
And then the weasels. The weasels who get into the big house and smash it all up and behave badly.
Yeah.
They're basically...
They just all go to Borstal.
I mean, there's so much to talk about.
Yeah, and also somebody also asked, said we didn't talk about nannies.
So Mary Poppins.
And that would be a good episode. It'd
be a brilliant episode. A
separate episode.
So nannies would be very, very fun, because, I mean, that's, again, people see nannies as people who are very anti-establishment will often say, oh, British public schoolboys' relationship with their nannies is at the heart of all that is sick in English society. So Churchill with Woomy. Was it Woomy?
Yes, it was Woomy.
Yes, the Freudian.
The Freudianly named nanny.
Now, we also didn't mention Agatha Christie in the Servants episode. Pippin Oz says, how did you get through without mentioning Agatha Christie from Miss Marple's Maids to Lucy Islesbarrow, hired as the perfect housekeeper in 450 from Paddington? This is a really interesting thing, because there are a lot of servants in Agatha Christie.
We talked about the maid in, what's it called? The one where she ends up with the clothes peg.
Oh, on her nose. Murder is announced? Is that
counting house.
Pocket full of rye, yeah.
And how, in the context of the age in which she wrote it, it's quite moving.
Yeah, because she has been seduced and misled, hasn't she, by the son of the house I don't want to give away the murder. But That speaks to something larger, which is actually the Agatha Christie's books, which are often derided as snobbish. The servants are almost never the killers, are never malevolent. And the servants are generally, perhaps slightly condescendingly, but always, I would say, sympathetically described.
Why didn't they ask Evans, Dominic?
Do you know that's one of the three or four Agatha Christies that Sambra Jr. has read?
Right. Well, he'll remember that a housemaid plays a crucial role.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. So it's funny because I was only talking to Sambra Jr. about servants today. We're talking about Jeeves and Wooster because he loves Jeeves and Wooster. And he said to me, who do you think really runs that household, Bertie or Jeeves? And of course, Jeeves runs it, doesn't he, Tom? I mean,
definitely. Yeah,
that's the pleasure of it. So actually, servant, the idea, funnily enough, although we did talk about writers and servants, so we talked about Virginia Woolf and Catherine Mansfield, servants in fiction are never normally shown pejoratively, so, are they?
Jeeves, Sam.
Sam saves the day. Sam, incredibly loyal. I mean, it's interesting that Sam, throughout the whole book, never really deviates from calling Frodo Mr. Frodo.
But isn't it a middle-class fantasy?
What?
I mean...
It's Tolkien as Batman, isn't it? Isn't that the...
Yeah.
That's the relationship. It's First World War Batman.
Just before we finish, people are asking, is another Twitter World Cup tournament in the works? That's from Lucas Roth. And SOS Klaus Fitz is saying, it's ages since we had a last top 10 episode. Now, Dominic, there's a reason why neither of those formats have featured, isn't there?
You're dumping me in here, Tom, because I know you really want to do both those things. I think I'm not saying we won't ever do them. I think we will do them. I think they will definitely happen. But I think sometimes we have to be careful about doing. We don't want to do episodes just for people who are on social media and using social media a lot. So that's one reason why we're cautious about World Cups, because although people love the World Cup episodes. Yeah, you know, when we're talking about the World Cups, we're talking about not the episodes we did during the FIFA World Cup. We're talking about earlier episodes where we held our own World Cup, where people voted on Twitter for the best king or the best god or whatever it was. I think the reason for that is we're quite conscious that people who did vote love those episodes, but people not on social media some just didn't tune in at all because they found it completely mystifying.
And the top 10s, possibly... 10 is there are too many in there. So with the Polish episode in the World Cup,
yeah, we did seven
wonders. I think that worked better. So I'm quite keen on doing seven top animals in history, and it has to be one species of animal.
One species of animal.
Yes, yeah, so you can have the top horse, top dog.
You couldn't do it with some animals, though, could you?
Yeah, you could. Well, no, well, I mean, couldn't do it with a spider.
Shelob.
I suppose you could. Yeah, well, Shelob. The one in Robert the Bruce.
Robert the Bruce. Two already. Only five to go. Well,
there we go. No, but so a horse, a dog, a cat.
A cat?
Yeah.
Are there cats? What cats are
Hodge.
There? Okay, that's
Johnson's
one.
Cat,
that's one.
Hodge. No, but you only have to have one.
Dogs.
That's the point.
Would you have...
No. Listen.
I'm thinking it through now.
Top seven animals.
Yeah.
And
oh,
those
sorry,
seven positions
I see. Okay, I
have
see.
To be represented by an individual.
I thought you
animal
said you'd have the top 10 of each animal.
No, I'm not saying that. Even I wouldn't try and push that.
But you could do
top
that
seven,
with dogs.
Top seven. Top
you
seven.
You could have seven dogs.
Yeah, we could. But I'm saying to begin with.
Blondie. Boy. Prince Rupert's dog.
I would go for Boy. I would go for Boy.
Who else has had dogs?
Or Gellert.
Who's Gellert?
Gellert is the dog that unfairly gets accused of murdering his master's baby, when in fact he's seen off the wolf.
All right, crikey.
And became a saint.
Horses, Pegasus, Bucephalus.
Bucephalus, yeah.
I think Prince Rupert had a good horse as well. I can't remember what that was called.
Wellington, Napoleon, they all had famous horses.
Yeah. But the trouble is, when you talk about those horses, what's there to say about them?
Well, Bucephalus
very good
is
at eating grain, very
no, but,
good at galloping.
Bucephalus has lots to talk about.
Yeah, but he's probably the only one.
So we choose Bucephalus. This is the fun of it, Dominic. This is the fun of it. So I think that's a very good idea, and I'm
top animals.
It, and I'm
seven top animals.
It.
Well,
seven top animals. Anyway, on that note, something to look forward to. I'm sure one and all will agree.
So this week we are having a Cathar week. We have the first episode of The Da Vinci Code, and then two episodes. Tom brilliantly explores the very, very rugged and rocky terrain of Cathar historiography, don't you? Who were the Cathars? Did they even exist? And why did the French king and whatnot launch this Albigensian crusade against them. So that's this week, isn't it? And then next week, we are going further back in time to our old friend Julius Caesar. We told a bit of his story last year with the two episodes on Rubicon. And Tom, you will be taking us through
the Ides of March.
Yeah, the lead up to Caesar's murder and then what happened next. So that will be great fun. And then after,
and then we're doing Columbus.
And then right? Columbus, Christopher Columbus, and then Ronald Reagan. So lots of variety there, I think. Lots to look forward
Ancient,
to.
Ancient, middle,
yeah,
modern.
We do it all. That's
the fun of it.
That's the nature of the rest is history, Tom. Right. We will see you all next week. Oh, we've got our Athelstan quiz coming up at some point, haven't we, in the next few weeks for our Athelstan members.
I don't know when that is. When is it?
I hope I'm not jumping the gun here, actually. I believe that is...
It's the
21st of February. So if you're an Athelstan member, put that in your diary. And if you're not an Athelstan member,
Shrove Tuesday,
you have time to become one.
Yeah.
Just in time.
Yeah.
Because that will be very exciting. Right. Bye, everybody. See you next time.
Bye-bye.